Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, my fine friends. Welcome to the second episode of this abbreviated sort of in between season 9 and 10 of the Tom Petty Project podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Brown. This is the weekly podcast that digs into the entire Tom Petty catalogue, song by song, album by album, and includes conversations with musicians, fans, and people connected with Tom along the way. Thanks for sticking with me last week. I felt that the weight of the context for Peace in LA demanded a slightly different approach with that episode. The comments on social media were, unsurprisingly and quite appropriately, more focused on the events of 1992 rather than the song itself or the episode. But I did want to give a quick shout out to my pal and recent guest, Pete Nestor, for DMing me to offer some words of encouragement in taking on that episode in the way that I did. And I won't read out Pete's comments, obviously, but suffice to say they were, as always, very thoughtful and very gratefully received. Pete also mentioned a song that I hadn't heard of, Ohio, by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, which was written about the Kent State shootings in 1970 in very similar hurried circumstances. And I will admit that I've never dug into CSNY because I really struggle with Neil Young's voice. As much as I think he's a genius songwriter and an interesting figure generally, tonally, his voice just does not work for me, and that's always a deal breaker when it comes to a band or an artist. But CSNY put that track out 17 days after the Kent State shootings as a direct political pushback against the Nixon administration. So it's a great parallel, and actually a good song, that I didn't know about until Pete mentioned it. See? Social media isn't all bad. Another quick shout out to Lisa Kelly Pennington, who told me today, well, today as I wrote this, that she went 9-2-1 in her attempt to guess my ratings for the songs on Into the Great Wide Open. Now, you may ask, how does one go 9-2-1 in such a binary situation? Well, I call shenanigans, because Lisa was claiming a draw for her guess on Dark of the Sun, where she suggested that I tricked her into bumping her guess from an 8 to a 9. And I think in the coming weeks, the only real way to settle this beef is by having Lisa on the show to get some good ground rules set up. Nah, just kidding. And honestly, since I did that episode, Dark of the Sun has become one of my top-tier deep cuts, one of my favourite Petty songs, actually, and I might be leaning toward a 9 or even a 10 now anyway. But it will be good to chat to Lisa at some point, so look out for that one sometime in the future. Right, well, that's enough social media chit-chat. This week's song is the gargantuan track Mary Jane's Last Dance, a song that I'm going to make an argument about in the episode that I'd love to hear your feedback on. Don't forget that I don't play the song in the episode itself because, you know, copyright takedowns are a pain to deal with, and I do try to remain respectful of Tom's estate. There's a link in the episode notes if you do want to go listen to the song first, but I do think you might have to have been living under a rock if you don't know this track inside out. The first thing I want to comment on in this song is the title, and not for the obvious reasons that we'll talk about later. Like Baba O'Reilly by The Who or Three Little Birds by Bob Marley, I bet you Mary Jane's Last Dance is often mistitled by people asking DJs to play it. In the modern day, smart devices actually have the intelligence to know what you're asking for if you say, "Hey Siri, play Last Dance with Mary Jane." But back in the 70s and 80s, the DJ just had to know that Teenage Wasteland was actually called Baba O'Reilly, and that when people ask for Don't Worry About a Thing, they should spin Three Little Birds by Bob Marley. I did poke around some to try to find out if there was a specific reason why Tom altered the title line to read more like a book title than a lyric, but I couldn't find one. And my guess is just that. It sounds more cinematic and comprehensive and has a much stronger active voice when it's phrased this way in the title. When author Paul Zolo asks Tom about the song in his book Conversations with Tom Petty and mentions that the song had been partially written some years previously, Tom confirms this, saying, "That was one I wrote during the full Moon Fever sessions. I wrote all but the chorus. I just had that loop going around and around and really had most of the words and everything. And I played the tape for Rick Rubin and he liked it a lot and suggested I write a chorus. There were maybe 5 years between the writing of the verses and the chorus." Of course, all hardcore Petty heads know that the lyrics that Tom initially came up with in the chorus were very different to what ended up on the recording. In 2020, Mike Campbell told Vulture magazine, "What's funny is that when Tom wrote this song, when he first showed it to me, the chorus was, 'Hey, Indiana girl, go out and find the world.' It was a completely different chorus and we all hated it. A few days later, Tom came in and sang Last Dance for Mary Jane. I love that it can be interpreted in many different ways by the listener." And it's amazing that that one change, seismic as it may be, can completely change a song and transform it from an also-ran into a live staple for the better part of 2.5 decades. In fact, Mary Jane's Last Dance falls 7th in the Heartbreakers live catalogue, being played 552 times live according to setlist.fm. This puts it behind only American Girl, Refugee, Listen to Her Heart, and The Big Three from Full Moon Fever in terms of the number of times it was played live. It was the second song in the set list on the 40th anniversary tour and was included on the recent Fillmore 97 release in a very extended jam format. If you go listen to that version, and I'll leave a link in the episode notes as I usually do, you see how well it works as a song that you can really extend and have fun with, as well as a perfectly constructed pop song. Released in November of 1993, the song reached number 14 on the Billboard chart and number 1 on the mainstream rock chart. It also peaked at number 5 in Canada and went number 2 in Portugal. I've always said the Portuguese have excellent taste in rock music. I have made the argument in public that Mary Jane's Last Dance is probably the finest song recorded specifically for a greatest hits album that actually deserves to be on that greatest hits album. And if you know of any others, make sure you let me know in the comments. A few people, I'd posted this on my personal Facebook page and a few people have got back to me on that. So I'll probably post a list of those and we'll sort of maybe have a little bit of fun with that and see if we can weed down which ones, you know, rank them or figure out which ones do belong on those greatest hits and which don't. Also, Tom famously declined to pursue any legal action against California funk rockers Red Hot Chili Peppers for their appropriation of the chord progression and groove for their song Danny California, saying that he felt that there was no negative intent and that a lot of rock and roll songs sound alike. Well, look, I've probably waffled on enough now, eh? And I should really start talking about the song itself. As soon as Mary Jane's Last Dance starts, the song throws back to that early Heartbreakers production with the really hard right and left panning of Mike and Tom's guitars. Tom's playing that main riff with Mike adding in those harmonics before joining in the riff after four bars. We also hear Stan Lynch clicking his sticks together before rolling the snare into that lovely deep floor tom hit and into the meat of the intro. There's also a really cool slide down the neck by Howie Epstein on the bass guitar leading into those next four bars with the full band playing. It's a moody, atmospheric intro that leaves you wondering where the song is going to take you. The interplay between Tom and Mike in that main riff is just glorious. Tom is mixed slightly lower on that right-hand side and is playing the staccato chopping lick, and Mike's adding in those little step-up notes at the end of each phrase to fill that part out. And we often talk about Mike Campbell playing for the song, and I was talking to an upcoming Petty 8 guest about how perfectly he understood what parts to play to complement whatever Tom was doing. There's a very good reason that Tom didn't go into the studio without Mike Campbell, even on his solo records, because his sense of when to add and when to back off is impeccable, and it's highlighted superbly on this song and emphasized by Rick Rubin's production choice to really pan those guitars to separate them. You also hear Ben Montench's low organ part swirling around in the background, but it's mixed down low so it doesn't intrude on that twin guitar attack, which is, you know, kind of the focus at this point. We talked a lot during these last two seasons about production. Jeff Lynne has a very distinct production style that is very, very different to Rick Rubin's. Rubin's approach often feels like it's basically just trying to capture the best single take of any given song. Now, of course, that's not true, and there's plenty of overdubbing and punching in and redoing going on, and we'll talk lots more about production next season during the Wildflowers album, but when you listen to how this song sounds, even before the lyrics come in, it just feels like a band playing a song in a smoky little bar someplace. It has a flow and a feel to it that is just very, very natural. When Tom finally brings in the opening verse, it's another sizzling opening line. She grew up in an Indiana town, had a good-looking mama who never was around, and straight away, we get a little Tom Pettyism. In conversations with Tom Petty, he's discussing the merits of including lyric sheets with albums, seemingly arguing against it initially before conceding, I should always have them because my diction is not that good and my phrasing tends to stretch words, so sometimes people have different ideas of what I'm singing. And in this one, the lyric is printed as in an Indiana town. But when you listen to the way Tom drags the word, he doesn't sing an, he sings in a Indiana town, but he drags that a vowel out so that it actually fits into that next vowel. It makes that line feel more narrative and, you know, rather than poetic. It sounds exactly like how someone with a slight drawl to their speech pattern is going to say that phrase. This is accentuated by the fact that Tom does say an in the last line of this first verse, in the line, with them Indiana boys on an Indiana night. What a start to this one here. Between the first and second verses, we get that wonderful harmonica part that Tom blows into the mic to make this one sound different again from anything we've heard to this point. And I'm trying to recall While I was writing this, I couldn't recall a song in the catalogue that we've covered to date that features any harmonica. And after a very quick scan back, I do see Tom credited with playing it on Damn the Torpedoes, but I suspect that's one of the additional tracks, not one of the 9 tracks on the original release. So what a time to break out the harp and use it to such brilliant effect. You know, ordinarily Mike or Benmont would be filling that space, but the harmonica just adds so much atmosphere to an already brooding, languid track. And you also have those high, harmonized woo vocals in that section as well. Tom's at it again in the second verse singing, she moved down here, age of 18, rather than at the age of 18. And it's a great vocal delivery too, right in Tom's sweet spot in terms of his range, but allowing him to really inhabit the character and let that drawl come out a little more than usual. Coming out of this second verse, I was listening very closely to what Stan Lynch is doing on the drums, and you get a real reminder of how good a drummer this guy really is. If you listen to what he's doing with his hats, he's opening them on and off beat at different times, and it's done very delicately. It's not a full open and close, you know, that very identical tsst. You don't get that from someone being very heavy-handed on the hats. Rather, he's opening them slowly, yet still getting that precision on the timing. And trust me, as a drummer myself, that's not an easy little bit of technique, and it makes that part really, really interesting. Well, to me, anyway. The chorus punches in without a fill, but that drop down to E minor 7th has enough weight that it doesn't really need one, or any sort of overt transition. In Warren Zane's biography, Petty, Stan Lynch actually comments in fairly blunt terms about the way Rick Rubin asked him to play drums on this track. He says, "I was told by Rick Rubin that the drums should sound like Gimme Shelter, and he only wanted to hear one fill." After some rather uncomplimentary comments about Rubin and his assistant, which he would go on to qualify as being hot-headed and unnecessary later on, Lynch concludes by saying, "I felt somewhat like I'd spiked the ball. They gave me a song called, as they always did, and expected me to come up with something cool, and I did. Take two." Now, there's definitely more than one fill in this song, and I think it's also safe to say that Stan definitely did spike the ball on this one. The fill leading back out of the solo is, again, very tasteful and exactly what the song needs, and he's not adding in unnecessary pyrotechnics to clutter things up. After the band had been working with Steve Ferroni for months in the Wildflower sessions at this point, it would have been easy for Stan to put in, you know, less than 100% effort, as his time in the band was, you know, obviously coming to an end. Indeed, the sessions for the Greatest Hits songs would be the last time he would record with the Heartbreakers, with Tom saying, "He left the Mary Jane sessions without even saying goodbye. We just looked up, and he was gone." An ignominious, but ultimately very Lynchian and very predictable way to sign off. We then have that harmonica lick sitting between the chorus and the next verse, rather than, you know, between the two verses. So again, just changing things up a little bit, placement and arrangement here and production coming into play. The next verse contains, though, one of the most oft-repeated and memorable lines in the entire Petty catalogue. "Oh my my, oh hell yes, honey put on that party dress, along with that big drawl on party." It's a showstopper line in a song full of them. But back to that harmonica break, if you listen to the left channel, Mike Campbell plays a completely delicious little up-down bend right around the, it's about the 135, 136 mark. And I'm not exactly sure how he's doing that, but it sounds an awful lot to me like he's using the whammy bar to get that effect. However he's doing it, it's fantastic, and I never noticed that little phrase there before. After this next verse-chorus pair, we head into a Mike Campbell solo, and again, with the hard panning, if you take out your left earbud or headphone, you can basically hear just Mike's guitar part. He starts off with those big double-stop bends for four bars before going into a slick, bluesy solo that glides over the top of that punchy rhythm guitar and Ben Montench's organ part. There's more technical wizardry from Mike that I hadn't ever picked up on in and leading into the seventh bar of the solo. Now, either he kicks in a huge syncopated delay on his lead guitar, or he's playing these offbeat, syncopated, broken fifth chords, almost like drone notes, just for a bar, before dropping back down to end the solo on the root A note. It's just another day at the Office of Excellence for one of the greatest guitarists of all time, but as always, is exactly what the song calls for, and then some. Okay, folks, it's time once again for a little Petty trivia. Your question from last week was this: which Elvis song did Tom claim that he and the Heartbreakers did better than the King? Is it A, Baby Let's Play House, B, All Shook Up, C, Treat Me Nice, or D, Wooden Heart? Well, All Shook Up was never played live or recorded by the Heartbreakers, as far as I can tell, so that was a little bit of a red herring. Treat Me Nice was performed live during the Fillmore residency in 1997, but was never committed to tape, otherwise, in the studio. So that leaves Baby Let's Play House and Wooden Heart, both of which were recorded during the Greatest Hits sessions, along with Mary Jane's Last Dance and Something in the Air, and if rumours are true, lots and lots of other takes. Thankfully, Baby Let's Play House and Wooden Heart were both included on the 1995 playback box set, but neither of them were ever performed live. In conversations with Tom Petty, Paul Zollo asks Tom whether Elvis was an influence on his singing, to which Tom replies, "Oh yeah, I don't really hear it that much, but as a child, when I was 11, 12 years old, I absorbed all of Elvis's recordings up to that point. This was about 1961. I really hunted down everything he'd ever done. I was just fanatic about it, so I'm sure that had a lot of influence. He then goes on to say, one of my favorite records that probably no one would ever think about is in the box set, when we covered his song Wooden Heart. I think we did it better than Elvis. That's saying a lot, but I think we did. And that was one take. I had no idea I was going to do it. I just said, let's play Wooden Heart, and just started it, and we played it. And that was the only time we did it, but it was right from the heart. We just did it and sang it live. Now, I'll end up looking at the Heartbreakers version of Wooden Heart when I get to covering playback in a future season down the road. But when you go and listen to that recording, it again drives home what an incredible band this was. It's an incredibly simple song, of course, but to drop into it so perfectly and so seamlessly, it's quite the trick. So this means that your answer from last week is D, Wooden Heart. Your question for this week is this. As I mentioned already, Mary Jane's Last Dance peaked at number 14 on the Billboard chart, but which was the last Heartbreakers song to chart higher? Was it A, Don't Come Around Here No More, B, Learning to Fly, C, The Waiting, or D, Jammin' Me? Okay, back to the song. After a setup verse to start, introducing the Indiana Girl character, we then have a second verse that focuses the point of view onto the narrator himself rather than Mary Jane. The last verse then takes us into a seemingly psychedelic space as we hear that there's pigeons down on Market Square, she's standing in her underwear. But a superficial flight of fantasy in this verse ties up some of the earlier lines in the song. There's pigeons down on Market Square, she's standing in her underwear, is followed by, looking down from a hotel room, the nightfall will be coming soon. This suggests that the narrator is actually watching Mary Jane. The next line is then a repeat of the signature line in the song, Oh My My, Oh Hell Yes, which is followed by, not, honey put on that party dress, but, you've got to put on that party dress, which has the implication that since she's in her underwear in public, she should probably put some clothes on. And this duality of party dress, which, you know, on the one hand is short for saying you should live life and have some fun, becomes more practical as the next line states that, it was too cold to cry when I woke up alone. The last line, though, is arguably the most intriguing. I hit the last number, I walked to the road. I hit the last number. The last number on the phone? Who is he calling if that's the case? Is he picking up Mary Jane as he hits the road? Look, I don't have the answers, and I'm not sure Tom would have told us what he thought the lyric means in any case, but it leaves the song on something of a cliffhanger. Also, the Oh My My, Oh Hell Yes line in this verse has the vocals doubled. I'm pretty sure by Tom himself rather than Howie in this instance. And it just builds on and punches home this repeat of the phrase. Another little texture I don't think I've noticed before is during the phrase, woke up alone. There's a little arpeggio underneath that line that I'm not sure whether it's being played on guitar or like a digital piano or electric piano. There hasn't been any noticeable piano in the mix. I don't think there is any piano on the song, but that arpeggio does sound like a Process electric piano tone to me. And you know what? If I ever speak to Rick Rubin, I'll be sure to ask him. Look, let's be honest, the chances of me ever speaking to Rick Rubin are infinitesimally small, but hey, a boy can dream. The outro begins with the harmonica before an overdubbed guitar lead comes sliding in and Mike Campbell adds another beautifully constructed solo that trails off into the fade. And I think I've said before that I don't always love a fade out, but again, where that last verse left us and the, you know, unsettled nature of the chorus lyrics, the fade out here I think works really, really well thematically. Lyrically, this is just hit after hit. And if you think solely about that original chorus line, hey, Indiana girl, go out and find the world, the second half of that simply doesn't flow as well as one more time to kill the pain. Just the number of syllables, the cadence of it, the way it's delivered, it just flows better with the music. And of course, a great many people have interpreted this song, the first two lines of that chorus in particular, as indicative of the song being about marijuana. When asked directly about this by Paul Zolo, Tom dismisses the notion saying, I don't think I was writing about pot. I think it was just a girl's name. Can't imagine that I'd write a song about pot. I don't think there's enough there to write about. And isn't that a telling line? I don't think there's enough there to write about. How many truly great songs have been written about marijuana? Illegal Smile by John Prine comes to mind, and despite it being perhaps a little more frivolous, and definitely not in the same vein as Tom Petty, I've always loved the song Hits from the Bong by Cypress Hill. But both songs, they sort of make Tom's point. They're both fixed on the only aspect of pot that you can really sing about, the high. Beyond that, there's not a ton of mileage in writing specifically about the subject, perhaps sweetly by Black Sabbath, expands the conversation just slightly by introducing the psychotropic effects of weed as a creative tool, but really I think Tom's probably right. Just as many people are convinced that Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is about LSD, despite John Lennon categorically dispelling this myth, and many people will say, yeah, but Tom, he was singing about pot though, really, wasn't he? In that Vulture interview I quoted earlier, Mike Campbell, the Heartbreakers' axe slinger in chief, had this to say. Most songs tend to morph and grow when you go through life. Some people interpret it as a dance, and others interpret it as about marijuana. I love that it can be interpreted in many different ways by the listener. That's the universality of Tom's lyrics that we comment on all the time. Now, no discussion of this song would be complete without talking a little bit about the music video. The opening shots are macabre flyovers of corpses in a morgue. Tom plays a mortician's assistant who opens the body bag containing a beautiful woman, decides to steal the body and take it home. It's hardly the lightest of tones, is it? And Tom really drives the car deep into the heart of Creepy Town with scenery-chewing glee and one sardonic wink to us, the audience. Of course this is silly. Of course this is mad and unnerving and very dark, but it's all okay because we know it's a dark fantasy and there's a misguided tenderness to Tom's character, even though we wouldn't want to be within 500 feet of him for any reason. The corpse is, famously, Kim Basinger, and I don't know if I'm saying that name right. I've never known how that last... I don't know. I will go Basinger for now. But anyway, at the time, Kim was still a huge star in Hollywood and widely accepted as one of the most beautiful women on the planet. When asked why he suggested her for the part, Tom playfully told Billboard magazine in 2005 that she's got to look really good or why would he keep her around after she's dead? I thought, Kim Basinger would be good. I'd probably keep her a day or two. Let's go see if she would do it. You can make a joke about it, but you do have to act a bit to be dead. It's not easy. For her part, Basinger was over the moon to take the job, saying, I did the Mary Jane's Last Dance video for one reason, Tom Petty. I didn't even care what it was about. I was just blown away when he called. Then I heard the music and I was so in love with the song. The assignment was very challenging though, and as Tom says, playing dead is not nearly as easy as it sounds. To be completely weightless is both physically taxing and in a way, somewhat dangerous if your partner doesn't have good control over what they're doing and is choreographed properly so that they don't drop you. It'd be easy to get whiplash or even end up on your head. And when you watch the video, you can see how completely committed to the role Basinger was. The water scenes were especially challenging, and she commented that the director was not the easiest person to work under, but that Tom made it easier by being so pleasant, saying, I always found Tom to be incredibly sensitive and sort of a backseat guy. He was just very humble, beautifully shy. And the video ends with a little twist that, you know what, I won't spoil. If you haven't seen the video before, there's a link in the episode notes, so go watch it. Watch it closely. Watch it right to the very end. Okay, Pettyheads, that's it for this week. Look, Mary Jane's Last Dance, it's a classic in the Petty canon. It is a great song. It's elevated for me by three things. One, that groove. The way Mike and Tom play that lick and the way that Stan Lynch plays ever slow slightly behind the beat to give that song that lazy, slouchy vibe, give it an immediately iconic sound. Then, Tom's harmonica lead, rather than Mike Campbell playing a guitar line or Ben Montench leading on the organ. Those two elements combine to make this song one of the most instantly recognisable in Tom's catalogue. Any Petty fan and most mainstream rock fans know this song within one bar of it starting. The last knockout blow for me is that chorus. The harmonies and the lyrics combine to really punch an already excellent song up into that rarefied air of classics. It's a hell of a track to have sitting around just waiting for a place to live, and thank goodness that Tom found the lyrics to the chorus, or this one could have been consigned to a B-side or relegated even further to the outright reject pile. Lisa, I'm not going to rope-a-dope you on this one, and I don't think it could possibly be any surprise to anyone that I'm giving Mary Jane's Last Dance an easily defensible, rock-solid 10 out of 10. The Tom Petty Project is a proud member of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. Go check us out on Twitter at DeepDivePodNet. I'm sure you'll find something there that you like. You can also check out my other podcasts, Seaside Pod Review, a Queen podcast that I do with my best friend Randy Woods, who performs all the music in this podcast, and the Ultimate Catalogue Clash that I co-host with the hardest working man in podcasting, Corey Morissette. We are finished with Metallica. We've only got a couple, three episodes left to publish out and then send out to you folks, and then we'll be starting on season three. You should also check out this fantastic podcast.
What's up, all you rock fans? My name is Mark Kameyer. I'm here representing the Quintessential Van Halen Podcast, and the podcast will rock. Myself and my co-host Corey Morissette are breaking down the entire Van Halen catalog one track at a time. We spin a wheel, and where it lands, that's the song we talk about. We go into it musically, lyrically, maybe even a behind-the-scenes story. It's all random and it's all fun. It's a show by fans for the fans. Not experts, not rock historians, just simple fans here at the Deep Dive Podcasting Network. We are, and the podcast will rock, and we will rock you later.
Don't forget to follow me on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube at The Tom Petty Project, and on Twitter at Tom Petty Project. Go follow, like, subscribe, all those things, and, you know, go leave a review or a rating, especially on Spotify and Apple Music, or Apple Podcasts, I guess, not music. Keep talking to me on social media, and I'll keep reading out those comments. And as a weekly reminder, The Tom Petty Project is not affiliated with the Tom Petty Estate in any way. When you're looking for Tom's music, please visit official streaming platforms, or even better yet, go to your local independent record seller to grab some physical media. Or you know what? You can buy media. You can buy vinyl. You can buy CDs right on TomPetty.com. If you're looking for official merch, go to TomPetty.com. And if you're looking for merch for this show, please go to TomPettyProject.com. Don't forget to check out the Tom Petty Nation and Tom Petty Fans Forever groups on Facebook. If you're not already a member, they are wonderful fan communities. Until we meet again next week, keep listening to and sharing Tom's music. Try to be kind. Try to say I love you to someone at least once a day. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll be back with you next week to talk about the last song in this mini-season, the Thunderclap Newman cover, Something in the Air. Bye-bye.